Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. My guest, and I'm feeling so lucky to have him, is John Sebastian of the Lovin' Spoonful, one of my top bands of all time. They're just amazing, you know, and I remember picking up one of their records in a thrift shop when I was, I don't know, a young teenager and enjoying it, but it really wasn't until I guess in my late 20s when I really discovered how great almost all of their albums are. There's just something very special, unique about them, so it really was a total pleasure. And just their place in American music history to me is huge. You know, country rock, folk rock, and the fusion of pop and the way they were able to do that is incredibly unique. And just the songs, so great. To be, you know, 21 and writing these amazing songs, it's very special. So John Sebastian and me, it's a long interview because I, you know, you only get one shot. So I really wanted to ask this guy everything. And I didn't even get to all the questions, but there's a lot of information here, a lot of ground covered. Hope you enjoy it. And if you are a Lovin' Spoonful fan, I also chatted with Steve Boone, the bass player of the Lovin' Spoonful, in January 2015. You can hear that over at WFMU.org/Michael. And it's an interesting one because Steve had some trouble with the law, shall we say, and he's fine now. He's cool, and again, good sense of humor about it all, but his story is really interesting. You might check that out, WFMU.org/Michael. So John Sebastian, super nice guy, great sense of humor, and pretty good memory, so all of that combines for what I think, hopefully, an interesting chat. Here it is, check it out, me and John Sebastian. All right, there's the Lovin' Spoonful, and John Sebastian joins me on the telephone. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning to you. I'm glad to be talking to you.
Yeah, you're coming to New York City tomorrow, and I want to tell all the folks about that later. But let's start with, first of all, is the phrase good time music something you are okay with?
Very much.
Yeah, I think so I'm wondering how you came, your father was a classical harmonica player. How did the good time music get into your life?
Well, I think it came through my friends. You have to know that growing up in the heart of Greenwich Village exposes you to a lot of people who are coming to Washington Square to play banjos and things like that. So I was exposed to my friends who were, go figure, these are all city kids that are fascinated by one type or another of country music. So I was going to Stephen Grossman to learn Reverend Gary Davis's style. I was watching Sippy John very closely. I had opportunities to be close to Lightnin' Hopkins and watch that. So that exposure, I think it sort of created a foundation for something that would later be expressed in The Lovin' Spoonful.
At the same time, when you are, you know, 12, 13 years old, was Elvis Presley exploding and Bill Haley and things like that. Did that stuff, you know, Little Richard, was that on your radar?
Like a fiend. I mean, you know, that's the thing that may separate me from a lot of other people accused of folk rock. Okay.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Is that I had this background, of being in a doo-wop group and then being in one of those Saxon guitar bands that just plays Duane Eddy and Bill Justice. So then I went to summer camp and met the beautiful Robinson sisters, and they Carter picked and did things like that. So all of a sudden, my fabulous rendition of Raunchy no longer really cut it as the real main thing.
And your dad was cool with all this?
Very cool. You know, it's another point at where I am a misfit in my generation. So many of my contemporaries were fighting their parents because of everything from the music to lifestyle and all of that. And instead, my dad was going, you know, if you're going to play music, you're going to have to get serious. You know, he wasn't going to mollycoddle me about this. Now, did I do it? No, I did something else. But it was great to have a guy pushing me in that direction instead of saying you should be in plastics.
Right. The millstone of your generation. So you meet these guys in the village who become the Love and Spoonful. Tell me about the early rehearsals. Was it just apparent right away that there was chemistry?
Well, see, Zal and I had been wandering around town, sort of, the village, really, playing sort of as a duo. But it was always kind of speculative, like, oh, gee, well, we may have a guy come who might want to play bass and another guy who might want to be a drummer. And for example, we had quite a good drummer, but there was something more about lifestyle that was so different that eventually we said, oh, this is too bad because this guy's good, but it's not going to work. And Steve and Joe kind of almost came as a pair. What happened was I had been friends with a guy named Skip Boone, and Skip was in a band called The Sellouts that played Greenwich Village as a kind of ironic thing because everybody else was so pure and holy. And I actually was very interested in his guitar, which I eventually bought. And I was also interested in the fact that he had a younger brother. And when we were inquiring about bass players, Skip Boone said, well, my brother Steve is coming back from Europe where he's been, riding a motorcycle around Europe, which Zal and I immediately put our ears up because, yeah, that sounds about right. So Steve returned to the U.S., heard about this from his brother, and we had a kind of a informal rehearsal one day in one of the clubs. I'm not deadly sure which one. And there was the immediate simpatico that I recognized it immediately. You know, here's a real bass player. He knows where the foundation of chords are, and it's not a guy who's a guitarist who's subbing on the bass, which was the most available thing in the village at that time. And it was Steve who eventually said, well, you know, you probably should try Joe Butler, even though he is in the Sellouts at this time. And we did try Joe, and that became our section.
Did you have the songs already, or were they evolving as the band went on? Were they sort of inspired by that combination of guys, or did you have them?
I'd say evolving was a fair term because, remember, some of the source material for this stuff really was odd things like jug band music and people that nobody had heard of, like Dr. Feelgood and the Interns, because nobody'd heard Mr. Moonlight by the Beatles yet. That was a point that really became a point of contact for us because we all... when we eventually met, we all went, Mr. Moonlight, Bald-Headed Lena, Dr. Feelgood. You know, we were all on the same page of this one album.
Yeah, it's amazing. You had a shared sort of musical vocabulary and quite a small one. You guys occupy this very small niche where you had credibility, but you started cranking out hit records and you made these wonderful 2-minute long AM radio ready pop singles, but they were very different from some other bands of your time in that they had a very human element, and they linked back to this other thing, again, balancing the credibility but the total crazy catchiness. So was there a plan? Did you sit down and have a meeting in a coffee shop and say, let's do this thing? Or, again, did it just evolve?
Well, again, evolving does fit the description better than other things, because there was another factor that a lot of folks don't realize, which was that especially in our earlier phases, Eric Jacobson was every bit as important to us as the Beatles' George Martin was to them. And I had already started making what I describe as toy records with Eric Jacobson. And it would usually include Eric Jacobson. We'd see if we could have Zal Yanofsky, who was working in Washington with the beginnings of the Mugwumps. And see, now I'm going back a little bit. And my relationship with him to really flower as we began to try to make these little cheap records. Eric had an idea or two in a kind of a surfing vein, and it was very interesting. He had things that he thought were a sure avenue to success, and some of them were things like the Buddy Holly voice, which he or one of us would sort of try to imitate when we made these toy records.
It's interesting because Eric didn't work with that many bands in his whole career, and I always wondered, you know, was he just a guy that the record company foisted on you, or was he the fifth Beatle, you know, for you guys?
Yeah, number two option. No, we were already together when we fucking turned down Phil Spector, okay? That's how much we wanted Eric.
Wow. So how long from that first rehearsal till you guys are signed to a record contract?
I'd have to say, even though it felt like a long time, that it was remarkably short. We were working several disreputable clubs in Greenwich Village for a while, and I'd say it was maybe a half a year of formation, and then between the publisher guys, Koppelman and Rubin, and the record company guys, Kama Sutra, we had our combination going.
So how long to record the entire first album?
That might have been one of the things we were doing during the end of that half a year. I remember we cut a tune called Wild About My Lovin' very early on. I think we made a demo of Do You Believe in Magic? It's roundly turned down by every record company in New York, so we knew we had a hit. it's true. That's being 19. Is that you go, sure, they don't get us. They just want those Italian guys from Philadelphia. They don't get us.
Yeah. So all in all, was it recorded quickly, or was it something you labored over?
I'd say it was recorded as quickly as we could, which wasn't that fast. Because first things like Wild About My Lovin' and a few of these, Rich Gal, Poor Gal, which we have as My Gal, they were cut one at a time. That is, we'd go in, cut Wild About My Lovin', done. Several of those type situations got us up to maybe four or five tunes. And I guess that was what record companies began to hear from Jacobson, who, literally you you went around and in person tried to demonstrate your 45 on what was then usually a very dramatic recording system. I mean, they had these voice of the theater speakers underneath the desks at Kama Sutra. So if you turned on I Want Candy, it was going to be enormous.
Ah, that sounds great. So you guys finished the first record. What were your expectations? I mean, did you think, you know, before it was out, did you think we've got hits? Did you, I mean, it seems like your confidence was strong, but did you have any idea what was coming?
I can't say we really did. We were very lucky in that Do You Believe in Magic kind of fell out of my auto harp at a certain point, because that really changed the dynamic. Even though we had thought of ourselves up to that point as a kind of a rock and roll jug band, some of the tunes, like Do You Believe in Magic, suddenly we realized that we were in the big beat game.
We must stop and talk about this song. 2 minutes and 7 seconds long, went to number 9, July 1965. But its legacy will be forever. Just one of those songs that defines the 60s, defines the top 40 radio era. You know, your band, it's bigger than all of that. I mean, it's just going to go on forever and ever. It truly is a magical, absolutely amazing number. What listening back to the playback again, did you have any idea you were going to, you know, 50 years later, we'd be on the phone, you know, talking about this?
Well, no false modesty here. Yes.
Right, because maybe every single person who came in contact with it just smiled and let you know?
Well, remember, there was the first go-round where nobody picked up on it. What changed was that Phil Spector came down to the Night Owl one night to hear us, and he'd been informed by one of the gents in his company, but Spector was warned. You know, this guy said, you know, Phil, there's some bad white boys down at the Night Owl Cafe. You ought to go see them. And Phil did. He went and saw us, and he spent the evening mostly with his ear to the wall, which everybody found fascinating. It was really hard not to watch him. And so apparently, you know, and he, we also, because we, well, speaking for myself and certainly for Eric Jacobson, the way we would wake up in the morning was to play Introducing the Ronettes and the Staple Singers. Those were the two things, and it turned out that both of us were getting up the same way: Coca Pot, Staple Singers, and the Ronettes. And so we already did You Baby, and that was one of the things who didn't see this coming.
So you just didn't want to be under the Phil Spector control? I mean, obviously, it kind of interesting to think about what would have happened, but was it a little too much?
It was sort of a combination of both, because we were listening to this proposal at the same time that we were going, oh, there could be things that wouldn't work about this. And at the same time, Phil also was aware of this and eventually said, both to the Love and Spoonful, and then years later, he said it to me when I came to him as a solo artist and said, let's make some records. He said, I can't really work well with anything I don't control.
Yeah.
And he was great. I mean, you know, he's saying, here, this is what's wonderful about you guys, is that it's a completely other thing, and I don't even know much about it. And so it was kind of by mutual agreement that Phil never got seriously involved. But like I say, the other aspect of it was that me and Eric Jacobson had been talking about this hybrid idea for a half a year. And anytime you talk to Zolly, he was saying, hey, so what about that band that's going to be like Elmore James combined with Buck Owens? When are we going to do that? And so there was... the dialogue was increasing as we went on, and it was the dialogue, of course, that created, what would you say, the mood of the band.
So very quickly, these songs are spilling out of you. You Didn't Have to Be So Nice was number 10, Daydream, number 2, Did You Ever Make Up Your Mind, number 2, Summer in the City, number 1, Rain on the Roof, number 10, Nashville Cats, number 8. Tell me about the songwriting. When were you doing it? Were the songs, were you a guy with a notebook or scraps of paper in your pocket or, you know, at the kitchen table? How did you do it?
Shirt cardboards. That's the way. Because you can pick up a shirt cardboard and rattle it and go, see, this is a song.
Substantial.
It's substantial, that's right. Yes, and to answer you honestly, things were kind of falling out of me at that moment. I think the approval of an audience draws things out of artists like nothing else. And that suddenly realizing that there were other people who thought, yeah, that is funny when you add Huey P. Smith to a Dave Van Ronk guitar break and come out with Make Up Your Mind. That's funny, you know? And that was suddenly, once we realized, what is the expression? Don't encourage them. You know, that was the opposite of what was happening, was that, you know, I mean, we were playing London to two Beatles, to Ooze, to, I mean, it just went on. There were two members of almost every really serious group that came to watch us at the Marquee in London.
It's one thing to innovate, but to innovate your way into the top 10 over and over and over again is really an accomplishment, I think. So when you get into the record business and you are producing such hit records, I would imagine that at times there are people who really want to make a lot of money, you know, and are really interested in you continuing to make huge hits. Was there pressure from Karma Sutra or from other folks
most assuredly, whether they were actually guys like, you know, putting my fingers in a vice or anything, there definitely was, I felt, a need any time that 2 months had gone by and a record was out. And then also we would get a call to say, hey, it's dropping. You know, we'd get that call.
So make with the next hit, kid?
Yeah, make with the next hit, kid.
Yeah. So what did you do with the money? I mean, you were 21, 22, whatever. These huge checks, I assume, were pouring in.
I'm sorry. It's the huge checks image that I'd like to retain.
Because no.
We were on the road. We certainly had any monies that were necessary to travel well, to eat well. But I don't know. I think after the first 10,000, it suddenly became a game of, well, we can give this to you in 6 months, and then somehow there'd be a reason why it was delayed. And yeah, it was fairly Trumpian, actually.
I mean, I don't really know the guys who ran Karma Sutra. Were they involved in the garbage industry? Or, you know?
Are you looking for the word garbage? Maybe. And listen, I'm still friends with all of these guys, so okay. I can insult them as well. And yes, Artie Ripp was really one of the movers and shakers who would actually like be in the studio and grab a tambourine when the when that was what was needed, and it was great. The other side of the theft was that these guys really knew a hit. You know, I liked the way that group was caricatured in The Sopranos, because I'm trying to remember the name of the Jewish ex producer record company mogul guy that's one of Tony's friends. Hesh that was exactly right, that he walks into a room, there's a whole other conversation going on, there's a record playing something, you know, that nobody's listening to on the radio, and he turns, I think, to the one of the beautiful there was the young woman who was trying to get into the club business and had one artist she thought was big and was playing his record or something. And Hesh goes, "That's a hit." and everybody else looks around like, "What? It is?" And I thought that, you know, those were the guys I was around.
Right, but also Hesh would find the way to separate the artist and the money just as quickly as sense the hit. Okay, well, that's an interesting part. That's such a sad part of the music business during that time, especially. I guess it's hopefully it's changed.
Yeah,
now
but you know, you hear sad from everybody.
Yes,
I'm the guy telling you. Not too sad, because other things were happening. You could never, ever in the future have such a compact audience. Everybody was listening to the same radio station in any given town, at least. And this was going to become dispersed completely. And so, yeah. It was access to the team, to the gang. You were suddenly in it.
If somebody wants to use a song in a movie, do you benefit from that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you've always got your publishing, right?
In many countries. And what it is that is very often a negotiation of a flat fee. And those, in many cases, are advantageous to songwriters. And other things like ads where it counts how many times it plays. Really, that's the music business now. Yeah.
Tell me about being a celebrity. Again, you were 20. It sounds like you were pretty grounded and had, you know, awesome parents and a positive outlook on life. You weren't like a lot of people at the time really feeling heavy, right? So did you deal with being a celebrity? I mean, ladies and traveling and people telling you how awesome you were all the time. Did you deal with that well?
Well, I made a few stupid decisions romantically, but the thing was that we weren't matinee idols. You know, that whole era of Jim Morrison and Eric is God, and all, that was all ahead of the world, and so. Yeah, we got chased by girls and got our T-shirts ripped off and stuff like that. But it was such a minuscule version of what was happening right around the corner with Beatlemania. That, and you know, really, you know, America didn't jump right in there and you know, elevate us to any incredible status either. You know, it, in modern times, the fact that Zolly and Steve got busted and turned the guy in meant that all of a sudden every reporter, everybody in this new generation of press could elevate themselves by dissing us.
Mm.
You know, it's like the new thing of where you're so woke. You know, it's the new version. It was the 1960s version of showing that you were woke by dissing the spoonful. So that really did change the cant of our you know, changed our course, or at least what was possible. Really, just
you're referring to this 1967 San Francisco bust. I believe you and Joe were nowhere near. You were in a different state at the time. So, and then and Zolly, who was a Canadian citizen, apparently was afraid he would never be allowed back in, and so he gave up his dealer. And it seems hard to believe now, but that really was the event that sort of started. You know, one of the straws in the camel's back that started the end of the Love and Spoonful.
And we do have to note here, we're talking about an ounce of mediocre pot. You know, wow, has the world changed enough?
Yeah. I read that, now I don't know if this is true, that there was an ad in the Los Angeles Free Press that urged people not to buy the records and urged girls not to ball
yes,
them.
That's correct.
That is heavy. That is unbelievable. Yeah. That is some backlash.
Yeah. And pretty presumptuous of some longly pimply reporter of thinking that he had some control over what these women might get it in their heads to do, which, by the way, was, in the Spoonful's case, always their idea. So
you were taken advantage of by women?
There were situations, I would say.
Yeah. True or false, the Monkees TV show was for a while going to be about the Love and Spoonful.
We did have a meeting in which some television guys, which was about, we so did not respect the nature of that meeting. I mean, we really didn't get it. I mean, to us, it was like, oh yeah, here comes. We'd already turned down a Coca-Cola ad, by the way. You get the idea. and oh yeah, here comes the sanitized version of what we're doing. Oh, but we can't actually write our own song. Ooh, that's different. So it was a 5-minute meeting. That's what I could say, was that it was so brief because none of us thought, oh, that's going to be tragic. Oh boy, it's going to be wonderful not to be involved in that. And that was really our take on it. So, and you know, and whatever monies or visibility they gained was fine by us. We knew several of them, lovely fellows, and you know, so but it did, I think, work to our advantage.
Sure. Yeah, just the different, they were the right guys for the job, not
yeah.
You guys. Yeah. Let's go back just a minute to Darling Be Home Soon. To me, very special song. I think I did the math, and I think you're 23 when you wrote that song. Is that to you a special one?
Yes, certainly one that I have learned from my audience that's held in high regard.
You sang it at Woodstock exactly 50 years ago. Do you remember that day?
Yes,
well?
I sure do.
What do people get wrong about that, the vibe, the day, the history of it?
Well, I guess one of the things is the first 80 times that I told the story of eventually accepting a pill in one of my travels back and forth on that rainy Saturday, going up and down these plywood ramps, that about the eighth time, when I was really soggy, I looked at it and I said, you know, I might chip off half of this. Because, I mean, that's my nature. I'm cautious. So I did, and had a lovely couple of hours of mainly just sort of hanging out. And then on just that one odd moment when I was back up on stage with some of my pals, Michael Lang and Chip Monk, that was when they said, oh, by the way, we need you to find a guitar.
So you were pressed into service with not have gone there planning to have performed.
The problem was the rains were preventing electric bands from performing. And so it was a kind of a grab 'em. Part of it was because I was on stage with those guys. And, you know, you got to remember, I came into that as a fairly, that might have been my most visible moment, having so recently exited from the Spoonful, that I had already opened for or been around most of the people at that concert. So I had no problem making my way around the site.
But good memories.
Yes, absolutely. Walking around the entire site with David Brown, the two of us just watching in amazement. Now, you know, David was, you know, most recently from San Francisco, so I think he'd been a little bit more exposed to the whole Summer of Love idea more than us New York kids had. But it was a marvel to walk around that site.
I can imagine. So Zal left the band, you left the band. Did they beg you to stay, or did you all know it was just time?
I don't think that anybody saw too much sense in any begging. I mean, Zali was absolutely the thing of having suddenly become, the guy that told on us. He had been the cool guy. He had been the guy that everybody could say, man, you know, there's that cool guy. And as Arlen Roth pointed out to me, yeah, and so many Jewish kids could go, look, there's a cool Jewish guy in a rock and roll band. You know, all of this just switched on the poor guy. And he had already had an inclination to party, to be, a fairly steady drinker. And as time went on, he did this funny kind of about face where he suddenly just went into the restaurant business, which is one of the most demanding. You know, you got to be up at 4, you don't get to sleep until 3:30. That's just like terrible.
So you leave the band, you start your solo career. You also did a bunch of sessions. I believe you play on the Doors Roadhouse Blues single.
Yep.
Do you remember that session?
I sure do. One of the things was that this was the dawn of Elektra Records in Los Angeles. That was the first couple of years that it's parenthetically worth mentioning that even during my association with Eric Jacobson, I was a kind of a mini-me to Paul Rothschild. I was just following him around. And then, well, the sequence was he began recording the Even Dozen Jug Band. Then he began recording Martin and Neil, which required my services on harp. Somewhere in there, I've got Judy Collins, and I was a studio musician mostly for Elektra Records, but not exclusively, for a year or two. And while I was making those records as a musician, I would then come back in the evening later, because I'd know Paul Rothschild would be in this tiny little, it was hardly more than a tape listening room, splicing some of these sessions up. And I was learning a lot about that. So specifically, I had already done years with Paul Rothschild when Paul began to do The Doors. And the proposal was, John, I'd love it if you would come in and play this tune that's, you know, it's pretty much a blues shuffle, and we need a harmonica on it, and the guys would love to have you there, but particularly we think that it may help Jim Morrison to behave. That was the approach. You know, I'm not exactly being hired for my virtuosity here, but Paul knew that I guess that was the perfect moment, because I was coming out of a well-respected band, and it did sort of snap him a bit to attention. And we had that afternoon when he really was behaving pretty much very nicely for Jim.
I'm glad you could affect the session positively. So is this true that Mr. Crosby, Mr. Stills, and Mr. Nash asked you to be in their band?
In a very casual way. You see, there was a point where I actually was telling them, you guys ought to get out of L.A., because you guys don't have a Joe Mara to tell you you suck. You only have these guys telling you you're fabulous. So you should come out to Sag Harbor, where I just bought a house, and I've got this nice big garage that I've converted into a rehearsal space, and you guys can, you know, do whatever work you do in developing the band. And what was happening was, it was mostly the three guys, their guitars, their voices, and occasionally I would sort of, there was a drum kit, because I've always been a completely amateur drummer. And so I would end up sitting at the kit with my, you know, foot on the pedal and my hands on the snare, and kind of fumf along with what they were doing. And the way Steven put it, when he put it out there, you know, it's been repeated. It's sort of been, again, it's another thing that has been misrepeated so often that people think that, like, I was sitting at a table and four guys, you know, they're going, so John, would you care to join us? What happened was, I'm fumfering along, and Stephen, we finished the tune, and Stephen says, you know, that's what we need on the drum thing. You know, we're trying to figure out how this acoustic guitar idea is going to be you know, the right volume and everything for us to sing to. So we don't really need a drummer who plays eighth notes on a hi-hat. We need a guy who's just sort of thumping along with this little thump on the bass drum and hands on the snare drum, you know, sort of a la Johnny Cash or something. And that's what so then they start spinning the idea out. Yeah, and then we'd have a voice on the bottom. Yeah, then we'd have another songwriter in the band. And so it flew that afternoon. By the next day, we'd come back to our senses, because really, I felt like, in all honesty, as much as I enjoyed those guys, and really they were at a wonderful moment in all their lives, they were really interesting cats. It was more a thing of that I felt like I'd somehow managed to extract myself from a band, which was a thing at the time that a lot of single artists had already failed at. And that now I was going to ask my audience to follow me into another unit. You know, it's really the times that tell you about this, about how far people thought they could stretch things then versus, you know, now when guys borrow other people's drummer and everything. I could no sooner have gone, gee, Felix, you know, I'd love to borrow Dino. Just, you know, you were making a record where it really needs some Italian-ass, you know, playing here. And he would have thrown me out a window. As well, he should have, because that was the mood. That was Blood Brothers time. And I would go back to the Zal thing, as it wasn't all being deported. It was the fact that we had now been in this group long enough that it had become one for all and all for one. And you do anything you could do for the guys in the band. And if what was required to keep the band going was turning a guy they didn't know in, knowing parenthetically that they were going to dump a whole bunch of money at a lawyer to pull whatever the trouble the guy got into, they were already ready to, I mean, I'm trying to think the huge name back then of a lawyer. It was a big lawyer of the time. Did Ali and did, he was just finished doing Ali. And that was one of the things they were thinking about was, oh, we can have that guy as his defense, and he'll be off in a jiffy.
That reminds me, how did you not go to Vietnam?
By a series of fake marriages. Here was the sequence. Again, I ended up in the same guy's office. The sequence was, I got my draft notice. I got a 1A. At that point, now you're waiting on the luck of the draw. And Eric Jacobson had a very good friend that he'd known forever that was sort of the Lovin' Spoonful's first fan. You know, somebody who was old enough to know better that liked us, what we thought was a great thing. And she at a certain point heard the conversation. I think she was living at Jake's house or with Jake or something like that at that time, and heard the conversation about, oh my God, Sebastian's 1A. And Butchie said, I'll marry him. And we all turned and said, you will? And that's exactly what happened. We got technically married in the fastest, you know, not a ceremony or anything other than just, you know, City Hall. And that put me back one step. Then another year or two later, they began drafting men who were married but no children. At that point, Bob Cavallo, our manager, came up with a conversation in Midtown with this lawyer that sprung Ali from the draft. It was a Midtown lawyer's office in a hotel. It's kind of dreary. The lawyer's asking me a series of questions, and the next thing that he asks is, so are both of your parents healthy? And I say, well, yeah, they're certainly healthy, except for Dad, who just had a heart attack. And he suddenly kind of shifted in his chair and goes, oh, and tell me, did you send any money to your dad when that happened? I said, yeah, well, he was in the hospital and I sent over $5,000. And the lawyer sort of stretched and got up and said, just, you know, he tapped on the desk because he knew that I was going to leave him $5,000. Just tapped on the desk and said, we're done here. You're a supporter of a family. They can't draft you. Boom. Done.
Now, good for you. I want to talk about this very interesting record called Two Sides of Keith Moon. There's a wonderful outtake.
Sorry.
Uh-oh. There's a wonderful outtake where you guys are running through the Beach Boys song Don't Worry Baby, and you are singing it and sort of leading the band. I don't know if you're familiar. When's the last time you heard it?
About 40 years ago, I think. Wow.
I assume that was just a party in a recording
studio?
Well,
it started off as Keith Moon. He's watching Peter make all, you know, solo albums, and everybody's making solo albums. And Keith has always wanted to be a surfer in his heart of hearts. And so he wants to make a record, and part of it is going to be surf songs and so on, and obviously Phil Spector songs. And so I do recall, I also was working with a guy named Ronnie Koss by that time. I had a band that I was traveling around with and had gained a friendship with a guitarist named Ron Koss, who had come from a band called Savage Grace, but before that had been a guitarist at Motown, despite the fact that he was a Polish guy, and he was getting a certain amount of work. You know, he's on like Benny King's What Is Soul and a couple of records like that. So I immediately said, oh man, Ronnie, this is a thing. Keith wants to do this record. And I'm in. And so then there were some much more famous studio type guys who were in it mostly as a result of Mal Evans, the guy who produced it. And Mal had done what he often was able to do, which was sort of create a social situation out of which some kind of artistic endeavor might be forwarded somehow. And these I'd say that that was the nature of the first session. But then they kind of realized they had to get a little more in earnest and record some things. And so that record has wildly diverse moments on it, not the least of which was because Keith was by now just really into being drunk at every moment.
It sort of sounds like fun, I guess. I read, and is this true or not, that you are a link in the chain of why people wear tie-dye clothing?
I'd say that a link in the chain is a good description. Really, the woman that began the Burbank Farm team, which became a tie-dye team, like you see, it started with a woman named Ann Thomas, a Brooklyn-born woman who'd come out to L.A. And by this time occupied a small part of a property that became known as the Farm, just as many the farms existed during that period. And she already was a batiker and had some of these dyeing skills already. So when tie-dye suddenly, she had some insight that this was coming or something, and I don't know, she just started dyeing. It started dyeing cloth. It was not garments. And then as time went on, people began to go, well, geez, I've got a one-colored shirt. I could hit it with a little bleach with one wrap and then hit it with some dye on the second, and I'd have a really multicolored garment. So Annie was teaching the rest of the folks at the farm, several of which became really, really good tie-dyers. And in a period of a few months, because, see, dyeing kind of brings in other people. I'll tell you why. You're sitting there. You've decided to do a bed sheet, and you've decided all the colors, and you wrap up the garment or the bed sheet, and you put it in the dye. And now after that, there's a period where you're hanging it in the sun to get a kind of, it's like a photographic process. So during that period, that dye is still warm and it's still active. And if anybody has any sense, they'll go, would you mind if I stuck my socks in that? I'll just do a quick thing with a rubber band and throw them in. Oh, yeah, come on, let's use it up, please. So that was what would happen with these little tie-dye afternoons where everybody was making these various colors. And remember, this is aniline, not procyon dye, which means that if you want yellow, you're essentially mixing a thing that is bright purple, and only after you pull the rubber bands off and hang it on a line in that wonderful California sun will it do its flip, and suddenly you'll have a yellow tie-dyed garment. That was the first step for that Levi jacket, and it kind of just went on from there. So, no, I was not the first tie-dye guy. I mean, Joe Cocker had tie-dye shirt that I think he got in San Francisco. And luckily, we were already friends, so I just made fun like crazy. We were back in one of those sort of trailer affairs, and I was saying, man, you know, you got to get with this aniline. That's a protein dye, man. That'll be gone, and yeah, that'll color all your underwear and then be gone in six wearings. And so anyway, we were actually having a little fun about it. So I certainly wasn't the first guy to tie-dye stuff. And remember, we've got thousands of years of batiking and those techniques in India as just one of many places. It was one of the very first ways that you could make a pattern. Think about it. Would be to wrap a garment in twine of some kind, and maybe you've got a wonderful nut that when you boil it all afternoon, it's going to give you a color, and then you dip it, and same thing, put it out in the sun.
Let's flash forward to the song Welcome Back, a number one hit in 1976. Just, I don't want to keep you all day, but was that song recorded in a day, in an hour, in a week? I think it was Steve Barry produced it, if I'm right.
I'll tell you. There's two iterations of that tune, and here was the sequence. I pretty much had no approval from Warner Brothers to do much of anything at that period. This is more of an Alice Cooper moment for Warner Brothers, if you will. So Mr. Folk Rock is not going to be received with that much excitement. By contrast, I got a call from a producer who wanted me to do a New York flavored television show. And so I took a meeting, and it was a very likable guy, Brooklyn guy. We got along instantly and were insulting each other and having fun. And I'm beginning to get this. So, yeah, like up your nose with a rubber hose, you know. There was this adolescent kind of thing to it. And by the time the afternoon was over, I was pretty much infused with the idea. So I went home and made the demo, you know, just out with two ghetto blasters, and brought it in the next day. And they were going to call the program Cotter. And I begged them not to call it that because there's nothing I could rhyme with it except otter. It was just going to be tragic. But I said, let me deal with the subject at hand, which is this idea that a bad student becomes a teacher, goes back to the original school, and teaches the bad students. So that was what I had. And, of course, I was a bad student, so I fit the bill perfectly, and I had the tune.
And so there were two versions? Was there one for the show and one for the single?
There was the first one that I did pretty much on my own. Once we got to the stage where they said, yeah, let's make this. My drummer didn't show. He was doing something else. It's one of the few records that got that high that has no drums on it.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's all the fact that Ronnie Koss was such a backbeat king with his Les Paul all scrunched up high, and our bass player is a he's a swinging guy, and he knows his James Jamerson, and it was a real nice coming together. And when it came to the backbeat, we just all got around a mic and clapped.
Yeah, it works. It just works. Yeah, I must ask you about NRBQ, one of my favorite bands. I know they're one of your favorite bands. Just tell me how you feel.
Well,
about that.
I think the connection here is that I came up to Woodstock. I started living here. Zali and I had you know, rekindled our friendship quite strongly by this time. And when he'd come to Saratoga, he would to gamble his Love and Spoonful royalties. He would stop by my house first and spend a day or two here. He was actually very interested in these restaurants around here because there are several good ones. And in these conversations, he'd go, have you heard NRBQ? And I hadn't. And he said, no, I'm not telling you, just like, go hear them. You're going to want them to be your band. So get over there. And Zali had never said anything like that to me. So I did. And they were like, what took you so long? It was terrific. They were making Grooves in Orbit, I think, at that point. And they immediately said, okay, here, you got a six-string banjo, right? You know, they put me to work. So it was great fun. And then I got to do several different things with them. And it became a thing that, when they were anywhere near Woodstock, or I was anywhere near Woodstock, and eventually some other places too, we would work together.
They're still fantastic. I don't know if you've seen them recently, but they're still absolutely
amazing.
Yes,
they are.
Are you still in touch with Steve Boone and Joe Butler, who do tour as the Love and Spoonful?
Yes, more probably Steve than Joe. But that's always been that way. You know, Steve and I wrote a few of the Spoonful tunes together, and so we get together and show each other our puke.
But it's cool that they're out there. You've always been cool with that. I mean, they continued the band after you left, so I guess it's theirs to continue.
I must say that I did, at that time, I had no use for it, was welcoming the fact, you know, the opportunity to play with more people. It wasn't like a horrible, you know, get out of my life thing as much as it was, I you know, got to expand this. I mean, you know, one of the things that had been happening is I'm doing all these sessions that just sort of come up, and many of them are completely unheralded, and rightfully so. But the volume put me in touch with, you know, some of these, the Wrecking Crew and the Italian guitar players in New York, and then also working for this guitar shop, I'd become friends with the Palmieri brothers, Remo Palmieri, who was Arthur Godfrey's guitar player, and all of these connections were kind of moving me along in this world, and so I was anxious to play with other people. And that really made it a peaceful departure.
As good as the singles are, and it's amazing that the singles are, every one of them is different. It's like an incredible body of work. I urge people to listen to the albums, because to me, the albums, when listened to all the way through, are so different than anything else that happened.
You're doing me a great service.
Well, I think to understand the band, that you need to listen to the whole albums. So do you feel the band is understood and remembered well? I mean, do you have a good vibe
on
that?
No, and no. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that the songs have a long shelf life, and the hits are visible here and there on commercials and things. But the Spoonful are really not represented for what they were. And I can tell you that what they were was the American band that was most interesting to the Beatles and the Stones. And Jesus, years later, Brian Wilson says, oh, yeah, you know, one of the Pet Sounds things was totally because of You Didn't Have to Be So Nice. And Eric Clapton goes, oh, yeah, that we stole that from Summer in the City. And, you know, so it was really... it really became an exciting exchange program, but part of it was that we weren't just regurgitating Beatles.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, part of the key to me of the Spoonful sound is that you were folding in these older sounds, but not in an anachronistic way. It was a completely organic making it your own thing, which made you really unique.
Well, I agree. In retrospect, I didn't quite know what we were doing at the time, but in fact, I kind of pimp my own records at shows where I have the monaural first three Spoonful albums on CD, and try to explain to people that these compilations where they go, well, here are the big hits, don't really tell the whole story.
I absolutely totally agree. You have worked in Broadway and in television and kids programming. You are a book author. You've done a million things. You've been parts of bands, and you continue to tour and stay really active. Tomorrow you will be in New York City at Passon Rouge, part of this thing called an urban campfire. You and Dion, who's awesome, and a lot of other folks. And the idea, I believe this is the seventh or eighth time they've done this, is that the audience comes and they can bring their guitar with them or just sing along. And the idea is that it's sort of a giant jam session. You'll come on stage, am I right? You'll tell stories about how some of the songs were created, and then everyone will play the songs together?
Yes,
is that correct?
That's how it's been explained to me. Remember, I've never done this before. I got talked into this by Jimmy Vivino, who goes, hey, come on. Dion's going to be there. What are you going to? You going to be a jerk? You know. So I've had this opportunity of playing The Wanderer with Dion once already, and it was so much fun that I need to do it again. And also the fact that Jimmy Vivino and I have a background in the J Band for many years and in the Black Italians and a couple of other things that I was able to horn in on here and there. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be a fun weekend just already with Jimmy and Dion and I. And this is going to be a terrific it's an opportunity to do something I've never done, and I'm real interested to see how it comes off.
It's interesting. You'll be back downtown, doing a sing along. It's like nothing.
It's more intense than that, because I'm going to go play the same room that I did my first professional gig as an accompanist, the very first. I practically stole the gig from another accompanist to play with Valentine Pringle, Harry Belafonte protege. So just to walk into the room, I know I used to bring Lightnin' Hopkins when he was opening for Nina Simone. And that's heavy terrain for me, even though a lot has changed. That's going to be exciting.
It's the Paisson Rouge. Am I right that it's where the Village Gate
is? That's right. That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Tomorrow, doors 12:15, show 1 p.m. Tickets at bit.ly/UrbanCampfireNYC 2019. Tickets and information there. It's you and Dion and a bunch of other folks, and I guess Jimmy Vivino, and the audience is encouraged to play along.
That's right. So bring your guitar and bring your capos, kids, because there's some things that Uncle Johnny can't sing in the original keys. Now, Dion, we want to kill him. It's not like that for him.
Wow.
He gets right up there.
That's great. Well, bring your capo. Good hint. Let's end with a Love and Spoonful song. Do you have an absolute favorite? Absolutely anything from the catalog?
Let me think about this. Let's play Bald-Headed Lena.
Okay, great one. Yeah, that's fine. I never would have predicted that, but it's a great one to end on. John Sebastian, what a pleasure. This has been so fun and just interesting. We'll see you tomorrow at Paisson Rouge at the Urban Campfire at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Good talking to you, Michael.
A total pleasure. Thank you, John.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.
Alright with me. Bald-headed Lena, has anybody seen her? Cute as she can be. She can't wear no wig, cause her head's too big. But she's alright with me. Tricky Tessie, Messy Bessie, both gals are full of stuff. Mella, Ella, Crazy Stella, both them gals are tough. They used to say, she's so crazy, down on night from day. Silly Tilly, lying Lily, take him all away. Bald-headed Lena, has anybody seen her? Cute as she can be. She got a cute bald head that's hard as lead, but she's all right with me. Sloppy Gertie, she's so dirty, skinny mini, she's too lean. Tracy's face is out of place, and Joni's downright mean. Now you take Liz, she's so dizzy, she went and lost her mind. Ella May might save the day, but she's deaf, dumb, and blind. How bald-headed Lena, has anybody seen her? Cute as she can be. She got a cue ball head that's hard as lead, but she's all right with me. Hoy, hoy, hoy. Bald-headed Lena, has anybody seen her? Cute as she can be. She can't wear no wig, cause her head's too big, but she's all right with me.